I just want
to share. I woke up this morning at 5:30 a.m. for work, and I got what seemed at the time to be a very frightening text. It was from Michael. He said, "My mom sent me photos of it snowing in New York. Is it going to be snowing when I get there? I've never seen the snow. You said it would be, you said it would be like 14 degrees or something, right? So it'll all be over by then?"
Yeah, April's pretty nice, Michael. Don't worry about it. Or actually, okay. No, maybe worry about it because... Wait, do you want to see snow or not?
Well, yeah.
This could also read like a really like sad message.
Read it sad. Yeah.
"My mom sent me photos of it snowing in New York. Is it going to be snowing when I get there? I've never seen the snow. You said it would be like 14 degrees or something, right? So it'll all be over by then?"
Now yeah. do it like he's angry at you.
Okay. "My mom sent me photos of it snowing in New York. Is it gonna be snowing when I get there? So it'll be over by then? Go fuck yourself."
Yeah, go fuck yourself, exactly.
All right. We're recording backwards.
Yeah.
Because of time constraints.
But it's funny because Michael still looks tired. So what's going on?
You saw the Super Bowl. Was that your first time seeing the Super Bowl, Michael?
Yeah.
What'd you think? What are your thoughts?
Can't say I liked it. It's just a really boring game.
It's really a bad sport.
Yeah.
I've thought about it. There's like an average of 15 minutes of gameplay per football game. And there's two lines per team. So each line plays roughly 7.5 minutes. And they only play like 20 or 30 games a year. So these professional athletes only play for like 3 hours per year.
That's crazy. Two line as in like there's like an offensive line.
Yeah.
Yeah,
they're not on at the same time. I mean, yeah. A lot of them certainly don't look like they're athletes. So maybe there's that.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, Michael, an Australian perspective on American football.
Mm. On American rules football.
Yeah. Just seems like they have a meeting every 30 seconds.
Yeah, with their boss.
Mm. Yeah, the boss is very capitalist. Like, okay. Like the boss has yeah, to tell like,
okay,
them what to
do. Okay, guys, we're going to maximize profits this year, okay? Shut up.
Coke and pizza for everybody. Yeah. I don't know. And also, it's like not as physical as Waterboy had led me to believe.
No.
I wanted to see people get spear tackled. And
there was one where a guy got tackled by two guys at the same time. That looked pretty painful.
Mm. We grew up making fun of NFL. Like you win by going over a line with the ball or by kicking it between the sticks. Nah.
Yeah, so you have to go out of bounds to get a point. That's what you're saying.
Mm. Yeah, and like deliberately kicking it so it'll go across the side. So you get to move from that line.
Totally.
It's just kind of lame.
This is my way to solve football. Every time the team gets the opportunity, their first down or whatever the fuck, they go for a field goal kick, whatever it's called.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Why don't they just do that every time? Because they can score from 50 yards out. You get 3 points reliably every single time.
Yeah. I guess there's no honor in that.
Mm.
I think they should try it.
They keep recruiting Australian footballers to kick their field goals.
I think there was an Australian guy there, right?
Mm-hmm. That's not the point of Australian
pride. This isn't like a sports ball. Like, oh, what are you doing with this game? Sports are weird. It's like, no, there's just some sports that are better than others.
Yeah.
That's our perspective. That's the Zizek and so online.
Mm-hmm. And I had no investment in who won or lost, but I found it a little bit annoying that Taylor Swift won the Super Bowl.
She was the winner. The Travis Kelce boyfriend. Did you know that he's a podcaster?
Oh, is he?
One of our peers.
Him and his brother.
Seem like he had a way with words, really.
No, him and his brother. It's just like, I don't really know what it's about. I watched a clip of it. And it's very stupid. Just like a couple of idiot guys talking back and forth to each other. Brothers, nonetheless, yeah. I tried that Zen stuff.
Oh, yeah, the tobacco thing.
It was awesome.
It's non-tobacco, actually. It's just nicotine.
It's nicotine.
Hmm.
Felt like I'd done a lot.
I have a pack right here, actually.
Oh, you're a Zen boy. Yeah, okay.
I've been trying it recently. I like it.
I just got really talkative, and I had like a huge rush because it was like a higher dosage than I've ever had of nicotine.
It makes you talkative. It's nice. And it's good for you. I think I'm going to do one right now, actually.
Yeah, good idea. Well, what do we make
of that? Can you show me what it looks like?
It's a little gauze pouch,
yeah,
basically. Mm. We'll try it when you're here.
Yeah, I'm gonna zoom.
This probably costs $1,000 in Australia.
Yeah. Oh wait, okay. Not only am I gonna try and properly introduce the podcast at the proper time. Hello, this is Hugh Jack and so on. I'm Peter, joined with Will and Michael. Also, and I don't think we've ever done this before. If you like the podcast, why don't you try following us on Spotify? Rating us, you know, sharing with your friends, really other things that people say.
Like and subscribe.
And follow us on Patreon if you want to get twice as many episodes and join the Patreon, the Discord community, and have a direct line. Have the ear of the podcast creators. I was watching V for Vendetta last night. Didn't finish it. Kind of lame, but also a very enjoyable movie.
I still haven't seen it.
It's fun.
Yeah, it's a fun movie.
It's more like I kind of remember it as like a bit tedious, but it's really fun. It's good. It's like there's a lot going on. The action's good. Very kind of post-Matrix. You got Hugo Weaving. Reality isn't all that you think it is.
Yeah.
But personally, I would sell my mother into slavery to see the movie Viva Vendetta Part 2.
I'm ready to sell my mother into slavery for a film called V for Vendetta Part 2. But what happened the next day? How will they effectively reorganize life? I think this is the great failure of the left today.
Hmm. Provocative.
You should make a Substack.
And we can thank one of our Patreons, Chantel, for giving us access to Zizek's Substack.
Yeah, thank you.
Very kind of you, Chantel. Yeah, Zizek has a Substack now, and I think we might have mentioned it, but
it was funny when it came out. Everyone was convinced that it was fake.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone, like I saw there's like a group on Facebook, the Zizek group, and everyone was like very authoritatively saying, "This is fake. You guys are rubes."
Well, I mean, we're so used to him publishing in such notable publications as RT, we couldn't possibly envision him moving to Substack.
Yeah, people are still complaining about it on Reddit, like today.
Yeah. Were they? What were they saying?
That it's not real?
Yeah, it's like clearly not Zizek. This is written by, some people say AI, some people say a teenager, some people say it's just
I think it's
prank.
Very clearly Zizek.
That's totally Zizek.
Like, yeah. if you've ever read Zizek, you know the tone of his writing. It's like obvious that it's Zizek.
I feel like if someone was imitating him, they wouldn't plagiarize him, and these articles plagiarize him.
Yeah.
When we was going talking about the sexuality bit, like what each philosopher would say on it, it's like I read that. I was flipping through one of his books like yesterday, and I saw that bit.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, people have problems that it's like, you know, buying into the commodification by a startup of intellectual output, et cetera, et cetera. I think it's kind of cool to get a like totally unmediated, like uncut, like unedited Zizek without an editor. And there are some entries that kind of resemble like journal entries almost.
Yeah.
The one about him taking a vacation with the son, I think was actually kind of sweet.
Yeah, like his love letter to Patricia Highsmith.
Yeah.
Was it like, tread carefully for you tread upon my dreams?
Yeah, it says that he's going to try to post twice a week this year. So if you want it, you can get tons of.
Yeah, there's
bonus obscenities.
Yeah, the top of the article, he writes, "Comrades, welcome to the desert of the real. I'm new to Substack, but already feel at home. I can publish whatever I want, when I want, and communicate directly with you, my readers. This year, I will endeavor to publish twice a week, politics midweek, culture or bonus obscenities on the weekend."
It kind of seems like maybe he didn't write that part.
Yeah, I don't think he would say that.
It's amazing he writes so much. He can post twice a week and still write like 3 books in a year.
Yeah.
Which brings us to the topic of today's episode.
Yeah, so the Substack, and we figured that, hey, why not go through a couple of Zizek's Substack articles? He revisits his Elon Musk Neuralink position. He wrote Hang on a Wide Brain 2020 about Neuralink. I'm sure everyone knows the implant that Elon Musk his company is developing to have a direct access to like a chip you get in your brain.
Brain computer interface.
Right. BCI. I remember in one of our episodes, fairly recently, we're like, hey, whatever happened with that? I guess that's not a thing anymore. And I guess this is the answer to that. They have implanted it in a human being.
Mm. Yeah, because the last I heard about it, there was an article that said that the animals that Neuralink had put the chip into had experienced, quote, profound suffering.
Yes, that's true. I have a CNN article here. It's talking about the monkeys that they put chips into. And there's actually a video of it. It's kind of trippy. The monkey is playing Pong, like that old computer game. And like they trained it to use a lever, and then they unplugged the lever and put the chip in. So the monkey is playing Pong by just thinking about it.
So you're saying monkey see, monkey do.
Monkey Pong all over you. Well, there's a good paragraph here. It says, Neuralink has been working towards using implants that connect the human brain to a computer for half a decade. But the company faced scrutiny after a monkey died in 2022 during an attempt to get the animal to play Pong. In 2022, employees told Reuters that the company was rushing to market, causing careless animal deaths and a federal investigation. I looked into it. This company has killed 1,500 animals.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Speaking of monkeys, do you know the Nabokov inspiration for Lolita, where he read about a monkey that was taught how to paint in a zoo? Or charcoal drawing. Basically, after months of being coaxed by these scientists, this ape or monkey ends up charcoaling a sketch, and it's only the bars of the creature's cage.
Whoa. Oh, wow.
And I think it's a nice example of Zizek's, we feel free because we lack the very language to articulate our own freedom.
Definitely.
So it's nice, like, to turn it around. There's this famous Stanley Kubrick photo taken from the perspective of an animal in the zoo capturing the curious onlookers, and the way that they're framed from within the cage is to make them look as though the onlookers themselves are in a zoo.
Amazing.
So you have, like, on the one hand, an ape that can only articulate its unfreedom, and then those that look on as if they're exempt or outside of these limitations and cage themselves.
And then added the third dimension of the selfie that the monkey took with the horrified people behind it. he'd stolen their camera.
Yeah.
But yeah, while they're in this video, they're like, so this monkey's playing Pong and it's stuck in on a straw that has a banana smoothie in it, which is, I guess, its payoff for playing Pong. And then you know, they have this like screen that's showing its brain activity.
Mm.
And they said something like they can, so we as viewers can see what's going on in the monkey's brain. And the monkey, obviously, I mean, it's debatable whether or not it has a kind of like interior, but in like Neuralink, they suggest that there's like any interface you would have with someone else with one of these Neuralinks is only through your own consent. But we're already saying with this monkey itself, we have like a direct access to a monkey in a way that it doesn't in, with itself.
Mm.
And that's strategic, like the Neuralink entails like an entire structure outside of the interior experience of it.
Yeah, and it conveys
in a way that we're not around, not aware of it.
Yeah, and it conveys like the interior workings of the brain kind of as like as the whole or an all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, as if that's all we, all of our experience is.
Mm-hmm.
Just those brain functions.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, so it's like part of the embodiment problem, right? Like, of course, there is no pure mind. There always has to be some kind of embodiment. So when people talk about crudely uploading their consciousness or something like that, the self's in question, it's like, what does my identity of myself consist, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like neither in the material support of the brain, which changes all the time, nor in the formal pattern, which can't be exactly replicated.
Totally. And the way that we relate to our minds is obviously not through anything resembling a brainwave, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole universe of things happening without our overt awareness of them.
Mm-hmm.
I finally watched Severance. Did you see this show?
Yeah, I liked Severance.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm really bad at, I never watched like the show of the moment or anything.
Mm-hmm.
But this is just the premise. But, you know, people, they sever their experience between their outside lives and their work selves. But what's interesting about it is that within the work self, they're very childlike and they have no knowledge of themselves in the outside world.
Mm.
So like they are a different person when they're in there. So it's like there's this hard wall between the two. And I think that's an interesting idea of like we're cut off in a certain awareness of how our mind functions. And
yet,
within that space, there's a whole universe of things going on.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Matthew Flissfetter has a good essay on Severance. Came out in the last couple of years.
Yeah, then things like there's like the metaverse, there's the new Apple Vision Pro.
Yeah, it's funny that happens, that comes out like the same week with this neuron.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I imagine that the guy who got the chip put in his brain was like, wait a minute, I just have to put on goggles to make this work.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was thinking again, like, it's no surprise that the enthusiasm about virtual reality intensifies as we fail to envision a life after disaster capitalism.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know,
it's like postponing the end of our immersion in capitalist reality, right? Like you get to opt in for the upgrade, like you get your Huckleberry Finn fantasy of witnessing your own funeral, but it's sold to you as emancipation from your embodied self.
Right. You don't actually have to be faced with, like, you can literally just cover over the world as you go about it.
Yeah.
It's interesting what you're saying, like, on some level, there's the experience. There's an experience of subjectivity in this very like reduced, positive form in the virtual space. I saw a video of a YouTuber using Vision Pro, and he was recording it, and it was an avatar of him of his face that was being streamed to his friend, but it was like a digitally augmented version of his face, and he was smiling. And it was really kind of fucked up because it's not how this guy smiles. And his friend was like, this looks really really bizarre. There's like too much teeth in it.
Yeah.
And coincidentally, I saw later that day a video because Anna told me about how people these days are trying to eradicate smile lines from their faces. People want these like totally smooth faces now. Like that's the beauty ideal, is like an expressionless smooth face.
Mm.
So it's like
a face that is not in the world.
Yeah, a face like as close as possible, a version of a face that is virtual. Mm-hmm. And it was a guy instructing people how to smile without producing lines on their face.
Yeah,
and the
yeah.
smile that he produced was totally grotesque and like psychotic. Almost sadistic, psychotic looking, and looked kind of like this virtual smile from the Vision Pro.
Yeah, apparently people are quite upset with this Vision Pro because they can't watch porn on it.
You can't?
No, he spent all his money on something that's basically made for watching porn.
Mm.
And you can't.
You must be able to get a cracked one or whatever.
Maybe jailbroken.
That yeah, surprises me.
I also seen that a lot of people are trying to return them because apparently they're very, like, they weigh a lot. Mm. So, like, it actually is pretty physically taxing to be walking around with that thing.
Oh, yeah. This is half interesting. What's his name? Zuckerberg. He has a competing version of these VR goggles. I forget what it's called. But he released a video this week where it's like recorded on a camera phone and it's him sitting on like a bed as if he's just like talking to you normally in a room. And it's clearly like a form of advertising for his product. But they've had this need for recourse to like, same as like Kanye West in the Super Bowl, he just recorded like a shitty thing of him on his phone and spent $7 million to make the ad, but it was just him on his iPhone or whatever. Like you have this incredible new technology supposedly, but in order to sell it to people now, you have to go all the way back.
Mm.
So yeah, Zizek writes, a few years ago, he writes Hegel and Wide Brain, which is actually great. And mm-hmm. if you want to, you can go all the way back to there and listen to our episodes on it. So he calls it Wired Brain, and he says, Wired Brain refers to a direct link between our mental processes and a digital machine, a link which, while it enables me to directly trigger events in reality with a mere thought, it also enables the digital machine to control my thoughts. Singularity, one might call this a singularity. Singularity refers to the idea that by way of directly sharing my thoughts and experiences with others, a domain of global shared mental experience will emerge and will function as a new form of divinity. My thoughts will be directly immersed into a global thought with the universe itself.
So why isn't this spirit?
Well, this is the question he's asking in the book, and this is why it's Hegel and the Wired Brain. He's seeing if he can mobilize, you know, this thinker that obviously vastly predates something as advanced as a wired brain, and trying to use that mode of analysis to understand it. Why? Because I think the unconscious, I believe, and the that negativity.
Negativity is what I was going to say. There's no work of the negative there, right? Like he makes this point about language that in terms of our expressing our inner experience, the elusive wealth of our thoughts, he says, with language, there is inherently a gap produced mm-hmm. between the expression and the thing that is being expressed. He says, of that kind of elusive wealth, there's this, what he calls a confused inner intention. And he says that, in a sense, we only learn what we want to say by effectively saying it.
Mm-hmm.
He says, we think in words, even when we see and experience events and processes, their perception is already structured through our symbolic network. When I see a gun in front of me, all the meanings associated with it are symbolically overdetermined. I perceive a gun, but this perception is given its specific spin by the word gun that resonates in it. Mm-hmm. And words always refer to universal notions.
Mm. Very structuralist argument there.
Definitely. But switching over to the Neuralink version that Musk argues for as a kind of direct expression, even a wordless expression, Zizek says, this is kind of impossible, I think, from the point of view of the kind of linguistic argument for subjectivity. But it's that problem of like complete positive.
Yeah.
The lack, the negation of not negating the negation, but like there is no negative category. There is no.
Like, how could you share the totality of an experience to someone, right? Because obviously something might mean something to you only by merit of what is not actively present to you. Like maybe it reminds you of someone you used to know, a place you used to be. And like, that's why an experience is directly meaningful to you.
Mm-hmm.
And in this, it seems like you could only be able to express through the terms of the brain computer interface. So like, there's no excessiveness to it. Like mm-hmm. there are like these strictures to it that are as actual as like that you can't look at porn, for instance.
Right, right.
But like there's these like kind of hidden boundaries within it that don't refer to the way that we express or experience, which is always excessive, right? And lacking.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's being sold to us as if it's like we're being freed from the limits of language, like language as words,
mm-hmm.
to the immediacy of image, as if concept is separate to sign.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Yeah. that the sign, rather than being like the way we communicate meeting, is actually a hindrance to it.
Right. But in terms of structurals, and that's like a rewinding to like a lower form of,
yeah,
of the expression, yeah, of the sign, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It goes to denotation and not connotation.
Mm-hmm.
Mm, nice.
And not even the myth eventually.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, his concern here, well, like one of the central concerns is the idea of minimal distance. So like we know that in order for ideology to function, as we've been talking about lately with belief, we have to experience some kind of minimal distance from our beliefs in order for them to function. Mm-hmm. And the same would be in sort of the horror version of this wired brain, is that you experience yourself subjectively as free, even though you may happen to be determined by the interface itself, and there is no minimal distance there, like he says.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Perhaps the saddest aspect of Neuralink is its cynical opportunism. Humans gave birth to a higher form of intelligence that, if left to deploy its powers, would reduce us to gorillas in a zoo. And I was thinking, like, to return to that earlier image of Nabokov's painting monkey and Kubrick's photo, we find ourselves exempt only in our subjective experience, when in fact we are always already encaged.
Because, I mean, the cage here would be something that is beyond our direct, like, experience of it. It's limiting on us in a way that it's kind of like limiting the exterior around which we engage with the world.
Right. And that beyondness is something that gets produced only through language.
Yeah. And he's saying that this absence in the way that we're being influenced here is, for one, a indicative of the way the ideology works, but also opens us up for new forms of control.
Right.
It's a weird, like, as a form of technology, it's so different than other forms of technology. I'm just thinking of what Marshall McLuhan says about technology, that they're extensions of man.
Right.
Like the wheel is the extension of the foot, etc.
Hammer hand, blah, blah, blah.
But this is like kind of the opposite movement. Obviously, on some level, it extends, like there's like the instantaneous communication, etc. But we already have that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think because it's so like, there are these walls around it, and it's so mediated in this very specific way. I don't know if you could say that it extends. I don't know.
Well, how different is the anxiety? Like in the 90s and 2000s, it was like, what is the fate of the body with these technologies? Like the corporeal, you know, and something like virtual reality confronts us with the fact that our bodies are already some kind of imagined virtual composite of partial objects. Like there is no whole constitutive body. So it's not just that you lose the immediate material body, because there never was such a one. Like our bodily experience was already that of an imaginary constituted entity. And now we get sold organs the idea that bodies. It's... Yes, exactly. Right. So we don't just lose the material body, but now our bodily self-experience, which was... that's what produces our sense of self. That embodied state. And now we get like, no, you're free to roam. Like true, genuine, individual, conscious experience. But of course, no.
It's also weird that this comes at the moment of like the ideological privileging of the body as like the form of not even subjectivity, but...
But I think that like privileging of like the body is a symptom of... Mm-hmm. kind of an unhealthy social body. Like we don't really have the way to kind of articulate the kind of life, the kind of person we'd like to be. So we kind of essentialize our present state.
Also like in a sense, like what is this level of like on a phenomenological level? Like it's clearly not dialectical because there's no category of the negative.
Yeah, it's pure positivity, as you were saying.
Pure positivity. And then in this sense, like in terms of like what Hegel says about knowledge and knowing, like absolute, Zizek says this in his Freedom book, that the lesson of Hegel's absolute knowing is exactly the opposite. It is a knowing which includes its own incompleteness. Knowledge is non-all in the Lacanian sense. It is not that something a priori eludes it. There is nothing that eludes it. But for this very reason, it cannot be totalized. But yeah, this is like, this is the opposite of that. This is like, this is the totalized all.
This is like,
yeah, it throws in the question, like, subjectivity, like, what form of subjectivity arises when it has nothing to do with this non-all, this negative category, phenomenological experience of nothingness.
It's like, I don't really know what it's like to wear one of these things, but mediated in this way, it conveys reality in a specific way, right? In a sense, is like completely knowable.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he says that for a materialist situation is that there is no exception, which is why reality is full of mysteries. Are there mysteries in this reality?
There's no je ne sais quoi.
Well, yeah, like another thing is that in the 2010s, when you had that kind of like Silicon Valley Western Buddhism attitude, like we need to set some limits on technology. Like we don't want to get fully immersed. So like set limits to your phone use, TV, social media, etc. Be mindful, right? And now with like virtual reality, it's kind of like microdose your reality. You know, like the limitations that we set, like a kind of soft prohibition on technology, has given way to the idea that like in order to access reality properly, to augment your reality, you don't think about why we're having the need to. It's just seen as like a deeper experience of reality. Have you seen videos of people like on airplanes with the stupid goggles on, pinching and zooming and like tapping away on the air with their air keyboard?
I'll tell you what they look like. They look like a goddamn monkey.
Yeah. Well, certainly telling them that first we're testing this on monkeys.
Don't include this, but I was just thinking of John Berger, Ways of Seeing, how like he makes a point, you know, based on Benjamin's idea that part of what used to form the experience of the work of art was being in the place that it was and being in its aura. And I think in a certain way, like, there's like maybe an aura to our everyday parochial experience that is completely eradicated by this form of perception.
Absolutely. Completely covers over that.
I mean, that's not something Zizek would ever say. I think he would be, in a sense, more on the side of like it always being a virtual perception.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a very different kind, though.
No, that was good. Because, like, he has that attitude. Like, he's talked before about going to art galleries, and he's like, I would never go to the Louvre and line up to see the Mona Lisa. I'd rather just, like, print it out on a piece of paper, as if the actual object itself has some kind of aura or the gallery itself.
In a way, we relate with the painting as being its own reproduction.
Right.
Because we know it from its reproduction.
Yep, yep, yep.
Well, it's definitely why people will know the Mona Lisa, for sure.
Mm. And like
when I went there, you know, you're in the back of the room, and this was like 10 years ago even, but everyone's viewing it through their own screen.
Right.
Mm. I took a pretty clever photo at the Mona Lisa. I turned my back to the painting. I took a photo of everyone taking a photo of it.
Wake up, people!
and then I dumped a can of Heinz tomato soup on it and said, this is for the environment, fuckers.
Yeah. This is so you like everyone who's an environment activist.
This is so you start agreeing with us. Actually, what I'm planning on doing next is dumping a can of tomato soup on an oil pipeline. I think that'll really bring the house down.
Damn.
Apparently the bombing of the Nord Stream pipeline was the greatest release of greenhouse gases in history.
It's crazy.
I mean, I can imagine there being ecological events that released far more than that, but in terms of human...
Man-made, yeah.
Mm. Do you want to read out that long list of philosophers and fucking?
Do you want to switch? Do we want to finish this one off and then go to it?
Yeah.
Are we done with this?
I can't remember what...
I think one could ask the question, is there a de rapport sexuel in this virtual space? Or is it, as Lacan said, il n'y a pas de rapport sexuel. Which brings us to our next topic. What did he call this one?
Notes towards a Hegelian system of sexuality.
This one caught my eye because only Zizek could do this and get away with it. He says, according to the popular misconception of psychoanalysis, sexual relationship serves as the reference of all our activities. Everything we do and feel has an ultimate sexual connotation. Along these lines, one is tempted to rewrite the entire history of modern philosophy. Descartes, I fuck, therefore I am. Spinoza, within the absolute as fuck, one should distinguish along the lines of the distinction between natura naturans and natura naturata, between the act of fucking penetration and the object being fucked. Hume. Hume introduces the empiricist doubt. How do we know that fucking exists at all? The Kantian answer to this crisis. The conditions of possibility of fucking are at the same time the conditions of possibility of the objects of fucking. Fichte then radicalizes this Kantian revolution. Fucking is a self-positing, unconditional activity which divides itself into fucker and the fucked object. Hegel. It is crucial to conceive fucking not only as substance, the substantial drive overwhelming us, but also as subject, as a reflexive activity embedded in the context of spiritual meaning. Marx, Zizek says, one should return to real fucking against the idealist masturbatory philosophizing, i.e., as he literally put it in the German ideology, real actual life is to philosophy as real sex is to masturbation. I didn't know he said that. Nietzsche, the will is, at its most radical, the will to fuck. Heidegger, in the same way as the essence of technology is nothing technological, the essence of fucking has nothing to do with fucking as a simple ontic activity. See, that one sounds pretty good to me. Rather, the essence of fucking is the fucking of the essence itself. And finally, this insight into how the essence itself is fucked up brings us to Lacan's there is no such thing as a sexual relationship. And he goes on.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
he goes pretty quickly into a discussion of masturbation. And basically the claim is that on a certain level, all sex is masturbatory.
Mm. People are using each other to masturbate with their sexual organs.
Not very romantic.
A very bleak sexual outlook.
Yeah, the other's just a masturbatory prop.
But yeah, the task is nothing less than, in this, I guess, essay, than a Hegelian system of sexuality in the standard form of successive triads. So, okay, what's he doing in this one? He does have a funny bit where he talks about someone who's named Dr. Carol Queen, where she writes about justifying masturbation. We live in a society in which sexual expression has always been legislated and restricted, and the pursuit of pure pleasure is frequently condemned as selfish and childish. A lot of people who consider themselves free of sexual hangups have simply rewritten the equation. Sex is only good if it involves procreation, to sex is only good if it involves two loving people. Masturbation is our first sexual activity, a natural source of pleasure that's available to all of us throughout our lives, and any form of creative self-expression. Wow, I'm just expressing myself. Each time you masturbate, you're celebrating your sexuality and your innate capacity for pleasure. So give yourself a hand. Masturbation can be a radical act, and the culture that suppresses masturbation may suppress many other personal freedoms as well.
See, I guess
first,
I would ask.
First, they came for the gooners, and I said nothing.
And then they came for my coming. And then,
what was the thing with? Was it Kellogg's where they made a really bland cereal? Like initially, the cereal was
cornflakes.
Maybe it was cornflakes, like
Rice Krispies,
to stop people from masturbating. Do you know about that?
No.
Yeah, cornflakes were created to stop masturbation.
How?
Well, that's crazy.
Mr. Kellogg.
It's a cock.
maybe when we adopted a more sex positive attitude towards our cereals, that's when they decided to make frosted cornflakes.
Mr. Kellogg, the man who created cornflakes, produced the cereal in the late 19th century and marketed it as a healthy, ready to eat, anti-masturbatory morning meal. He was a Seventh-day Adventist and worked as a physician who staunchly believed in celibacy and that sex was unhealthy and immoral.
That's crazy.
What's a masturbatory breakfast food?
Bananas.
His theory was basically that meat and rich flavored foods increased sexual desire, while plain foods like nuts and cereals suppressed it.
I see.
You know, maybe there's something to that.
If you start your day with like some Matrix slop.
But I mean, Zizek comes out thoroughly on the side of what that woman was saying is the bad form. One of the contemporary bad form of looking at sex is mm-hmm. between two loving people.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Because he says that we do totally ignore the link between sexuality and love as another form of the self-sublation of sexuality. As Lacan put it, love supplements the impossibility / failure of sexual relationship. It's not an imaginary illusion designed to obfuscate the ultimate failure of any sexual relationship. But on the contrary, the only link to another human being which is open to another human being is in its radical alterity, accepting it without any idealization. It is only love that makes a sexual act non-masturbatory. The true conflict is thus the one between passionate sexual love and a political or social or artistic or scientific cause. And there is no solution to this conflict. One has to accept it humbly as our fate. But this is another story.
I liked this bit about the missionary position.
Yeah,
like, well, the idea would be like in animal copulation, you don't face one another, right? So you're free to pursue your own fantasies during the sexual act. But with the missionary position advocated by the Catholic Church, it's not just
interesting how
bodily.
They call it the missionary position.
Yeah. I hadn't thought about that either. But like the face-to-face proximity of missionary is supposed to like establish a spiritual proximity. But he says mm-hmm. that it's obvious that the gap returns in an even stronger form because the face-to-face proximity renders palpable this discord of the underlying fantasies of the two people during mm-hmm. sex.
And then he says, like, nothing aggravates us more than the idiots who try to talk during sex.
Yeah. The gap is exposed in all of its ridicule, he says.
Do you think anyone dirty talks to themselves when they're masturbating?
We are bad boys, aren't we?
Yeah.
I claim I have nothing against sex without love, but I think the structure, like we usually say, what is masturbation? You do it to yourself just with the partner you are dreaming about. But what if
real... Sort of mental outsourcing.
Yeah, but most of our real sex, I think, is masturbation with the real partner. Mm. You have a real partner there, but you just use the real partner to realize your dream. So is all sex like that? No, it's love. Which is why today I claim, this is very old-fashioned romantic idea, what is transgressive is not sex. You can do it with animals, with dogs, with cats, no problem. Falling in love is a problem.
So we got another Zizek article here. From January 4th, smoking considered as one of the fine arts. He opens with, the impasses of today's consumerism provide a clear case of Lacanian distinction between plaisir and jouissance. On the one hand, we have the consumerist calculating his plaisir, maybe that's pleasures.
Yeah, it's pleasure. Yeah.
Based on context. Okay. Well, protects you from all kinds of harassments and the other health threats. On the other hand, we have the drug addict or smoker. Bent on self-destruction. This basic strategy of enlightened consumerist hedonism is to deprive enjoyment of its excessive dimension, of its disturbing surplus, or the fact that it serves nothing. Enjoyment is tolerated, solicited even, but on the condition that it is healthy, that it doesn't threaten our psychic or biological stability. Chocolate, yes, but fat-free. Coke, yes, but diet. Coffee, yes, but without caffeine. Basically, yeah, I mean, this is exactly what we were just talking about with Fowler. This is what we talked about with Fowler, actually. But trying to take the enjoyment out of enjoyment. But go ahead.
Great example of this. I sent you guys a photo a couple months back. It was a photo. It's an ad that I've seen around. It depicts a like young woman, kind of interesting, like cool looking young woman, and it says smoking gives me anxiety, and it's an ad for weed. So like, it's exactly what he was just saying. Like. Smoking is reframed as the thing that used to be for dealing with anxiety, right? Mm-hmm. You smoke to get over anxiety. Now there's this kind of like, I mean, what's anxiety in the Lacanian sense? Like it's desire for the object. There's like the threatening component of smoking, which Fowler and Zizek would say is like the very thing that makes smoking enjoyable, is now reframed as actually giving you anxiety.
And the thing that gives you anxiety, i.e. marijuana, is framed as the solution to it.
Exactly. But it's funny that diet, that thing that's been taking out the excessive enjoyment dimension, is conveyed as the thing which induces anxiety, the lost object.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
And it's the wrong way around.
We're seeking the kind of simulacra of the thing to stand in for the enjoyment, but the imitation is obviously not the real thing in itself. And
he says something great here. He says that the consumerist pleasures are in this form regulated by scientific knowledge propagated by the university discourse.
Mm.
Our pleasures have to take place within an act of consumption, like a kind of commodified act.
It's like you can only in this way you can only enjoy because of logical reasons, right?
That and then the enjoyment becomes the act of limiting yourself rather than the enjoyment of the kind of excessive moment.
Yeah, the pleasure of renunciation.
I mean, the enjoyment is always there, right? Yeah, exactly.
It's like the hunger art, the Kafka story, the hunger artist.
Mm-hmm.
Would you be able to give a short definition of university discourse, Michael?
Basically, the discourse that produces knowledge of the master. But yeah, he talks about a shift from the university discourse. Sorry, you go, Pete, please.
Well, that's what I was going to say. To the discourse of the master. The master goes to the end of its consumption. I guess like a pervert, correct? He's not constrained by the petty utilitarian considerations. The decaffeinated enjoyment we thus obtain is a semblance of enjoyment, not its real. Prototype of this discourse is the multiplicity of reports in popular magazines which advocate sex as good for your health. Hey, this is a tie-in to what we were just saying. I mean, this is like sex without sex, right?
Yeah, it's like the prohibition is taken up for like the spontaneous moral reason that
for utility.
Should...
Yeah.
Yeah.
You wouldn't do something for its own sake. You wouldn't smoke just to smoke.
I love that. I love when Robert Fowler said that thing about drinking.
Mm-hmm.
How it's a dangerous form of consumption because it brings people together and muttering in corners of bars. Planning the revolution.
Gavrilli Princip wasn't in the back of that bar with the society of the black hand.
Yeah. Smoking a huge fatty.
Yes, yeah, smoking a fatty and drinking a non-alcoholic beer.
But I like this idea that like you have certain pleasures that get deprived of their negative substance. I was like, so, like, sex deprived of it is safe sex, and the true safe sex is masturbation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and like we were saying in the last episode, actually, the strengthening of superego pressure.
Mm-hmm.
He says that this is expressed in the strengthening of the prohibition in the warnings on smoking packs,
mm-hmm.
where it at one time said,
"Uh-huh,
smoking may seriously endanger your health." And then he says, more recently, the tone gets more and more aggressive, shifting from the university discourse to a direct master's injunction. Smoking kills. A clear warning that this excess enjoyment is lethal. Furthermore, this warning is getting larger and larger, mm-hmm. accompanied by hardcore photos of open lungs, black from tar, etc. No wonder, then, that the prohibition of smoking expands almost exponentially. First, there's like smoke-free offices.
Those old days where you smoking section of restaurants.
This is great. Mm-hmm. This is great. He says, these prohibitions target the other's excessive and risky enjoyment embodied in the act of irresponsibility, lighting a cigarette and inhaling deeply with unabashed pleasure. Indeed, as Lacan put it, after God is dead, nothing is any more permitted.
That's a great twist. I mean, it's something of like biopower in this, right? Like there's something
big time
that the state wants to control about our enjoyment and that it needs to limit our enjoyment so as to kind of like divide us.
Well, people would say, basically, well, you know, there's an undue stress put on the health system by these senseless smokers who are, you know, putting their bodies at risk, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, there's austerity and they're defunding the health system. It's only the people, it's only the poor who have lived in the wrong way. They're the reason why the health systems are failing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because like the injunction is now to, it's always to enjoy, but it's now to enjoy safely, to enjoy healthily, to enjoy in such a way that you continue to be productive. And like, you know, you can see that clearly in the Silicon Valley in the, again, like the 2010s, people microdosing LSD and stuff like that, where it's like, this is unlocking your creative power, but it's always within the context of innovation, tech, and, you know.
But who is this other whose addictive behavior, whose display of excessive enjoyment disturbs us so much? It is none other than what? The neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
He says we should focus on what kind of subjectivity is implied in this obsession with different modes of harassment.
Mm.
Like in that idea that the neighbor kind of harasses you with their excessive enjoyment.
Yeah, because he says like tolerance coincides with its opposite, right? So your duty to be tolerant towards the other effectively means that you shouldn't get too close to them, like you shouldn't intrude into their space and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So all these forms like the form of enjoyment. Of tolerance. Yeah, these forms of enjoyment impinge on others. That's the ideology.
Yeah, like the principle of tolerance is like to not even hear from the other, the neighbor now. It's not to like, you know, deal with their excesses.
Right. And that's why something like the virtual reality goggles, that kind of thing, these new innovations in these technologies, they allow you to have a further distance. Like you don't get the excess and trauma of an encounter with the
other. Your entire experience of the world is like with these goggles on, an attempt to completely ignore the harassments of and enjoyments of those around you.
Yeah. It provides you a form of mediation at a distance.
Yeah. It's diet life. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, diet life. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
It's the same thing with noise-canceling headphones too.
And I guess like the point behind it is that there's something traumatic about the other's enjoyment, whether that's something like smoking and alcohol or help me out here.
Sex, wearing fur.
Like enjoyments?
I'm just trying to tie it all together so we can end on the unit.
What
he references in two of these articles.
You stopped short of this part, but I think this might tie it together. He says, what one should focus on is what kind of subjectivity is implied with the obsession with the different modes of harassment. The narcissistic subjectivity for which everything others do, address me, look at me, is potentially a threat. So that, as Sartre put it long ago, hell is other people.
Yeah, and that's the point he's making as well about the stamina training unit and the vibrator, right? Like what you buy as a partial object, some kind of erogenous zone alone, deprived of its additional burden of having to actually deal with another entire person.
Yeah, he says this is the paradox of surplus enjoyment as purist. The more the object is veiled, the more intensely disturbing is the minimal trace of its remainder. So like we're trying to eradicate these excesses, but we're getting something that is like so much more kind of strong and specific and
like isolating.
And
just like with the Neuralink, we're unaware the extent to which this seemingly kind of spontaneous idea that we should be more healthy, we should hide ourselves from other people's excesses and enjoyments and harassments, that this position itself is kind of symptom of greater ideology. We feel this way within a certain context, within a certain kind of political and economic and ideological context. There's something at work in our seemingly spontaneous ideas of our kind of personal autonomy at this moment.
What do you think of his solution here? Like the idea that romance is generated by being able to avoid the encounter with another person? With this stamina unit and vibrator, like he says,
it's kind of,
if our hands brush against each other while pouring tea and we slowly descend into intimacy, we can sit up in bed having actual intense sex without any superego pressure, and romance is thus born again.
Well, that's kind of what he says about like courtly love, right?
Yeah.
Like it seems to be this very kind of prudish, rote form of, you know, this like chivalrous kind of code. But in a way, these little moments that are so important in that mode of romance are kind of all the more powerful Right. And yeah, less kind of taken up in the,
well, the idea with
very ideological, like, routine of consent and
with Courtly Love, I think the emphasis is on a delayed encounter.
Yeah. Right.
That's where the enjoyment gets produced. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So like if you just have the real raw, it needs to be supported or supplemented by fantasy. And so Zizek has here a kind of like brute example of like, okay, so if we just take the sexual act at its most reduced, which is the vibrator in the stamina unit, and then we can kind of outsource or what's the word, displace that act externally, then perhaps we have this minimal distance where we're able to actually produce true intimacy.
We're kind of like, short-circuiting the ideological game there.
Yeah.
That something else can happen.
Because he thinks that deprives the super-egoic injunction.
The verily vivacious vaginal vexing of, I don't know, I was trying to do a Viva Vendetta twist on it.
One must imagine Sisyphus horny.
That's Courtly Love.
Yeah.
I'm more and more thinking about this idea that, like, the Apple Vision Pro doesn't allow you to watch porn. Don't you think that's a really strange absence?
That's the whole selling point of virtual reality. That's like why people get it.
Mm. And like colloquially, we all know that like concomitant with these technologies, pornography's always been at the forefront.
Yeah. Yeah.
And here it's this vanishing mediator. Like people want these goggles so they can have crazy jerk-off sessions. And now they're deprived of it.
Well, now they'll just have to find very anodyne things, erotic.
Pinching and zooming, but you don't get any boobs.
You're not pinching any boobs in there.
The future sucks.
Future's... okay, well, you know, there's Zizek's Substack. I'm sure we'll be reading and discussing more of it in the future.
And we're interviewing Anna Kornblue next on her new book, Immediacy, The Style of Too Late Capitalism. And then we've got Mladen Dalar right after that.
Very exciting.
Yeah. From all of us here at Zizek and so on, see you later.
Bye-bye.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Could hide 'neath the wing of the bluebird as she sings. The 6 o'clock alarm would never ring. But it rings and I rise, wipe the sleep out of my eyes. We're shaven rings. A white knight on his steed.